Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Have you ever experienced a dry, itchy scalp or ever wondered why your color isn't lasting as long as your hairdresser promised? Well, unfiltered, mineral-filled water could be the reason why. Did you know hard water is a leading cause of damaged hair and dry, irritated skin? And that about 85% of the United States uses hard water, filled with dissolved minerals and added chlorine. That's where Canopy's new filtered showerhead comes in. Canopy, known for their beauty hacks and reimagined humidifier, has revolutionized the filtered showerhead. Dermatologists recommended this unique three-stage filtration system greatly reduces contaminants and odors in your shower water, leaving you with healthy hair and glowing skin. Best of all, the Canopy filtered showerhead is hassle-free. Installation is a breeze. We put it in, it took like 30 seconds, guys. And its unique quick-release filter replacement feature allows for seamless filter replacement unlike any others on the market. Go to getcanopy.co to save $25 on your Canopy filtered showerhead purchase today with Canopy's hassle-free filter subscription. Even better, our listeners can use code PANTSUIT at checkout to save an additional 10% off your Canopy purchase. Hurry, your hair and skin will thank you.
I love spring. I feel like it's the perfect time to hit reset. Get rid of the things that don't work, bring in things that do work. With Nextivo Naturals CBD products, you can get rid of oil-based CBD, which doesn't work very well, and introduce CBD that will help you live well, happily, with less stress and greater sleep quality. Oil-based CBD just doesn't mix well with our bodies because our bodies are mostly water. But Nextivo Naturals developed a clinically tested, water-soluble form of CBD, and their gummies and capsules are proven to work faster and absorb better than oil-based products. For a limited time in April, you can get 60% off an order of $40 or more by using code PANTSUIT at Nextivo.com. I really value the sleep complex. It is CBD with melatonin, and it just helps take the edge off my day when my thoughts are racing as I hit the pillow. I can just kind of feel myself melting away. I wake up refreshed. I sleep all night. I think it is such a good product that has been, for years now, really valuable to me. Give your life a refresh with more effective and fast-acting CBD from Nextivo Naturals. For a limited time in April, get 60% off any order of $40 or more by using code PANTSUIT at Nextivo.com. That's 60% off any order of $40 or more only in April at Nextivo.com with promo code PANTSUIT.
One of the things that was really, you know, prevalent in kind of that national conversation after that shooting was the rate at which the Amish forgave the shooter and the rate at which the community really came together.
This is Sarah.
This is Beth.
You're listening to Pantsuit Politics,
the home of grace-filled political conversations.
Nuance Nation is in full swing. Next up, Michigan with Representative Haley Stevens in Troy, Michigan on September 14th. Then we'll be heading to Louisville to have a conversation with Amy McGrath on September 28th. And then we've got tickets for sale, yay, for Dallas and D.C. So get the link in the show notes and get your tickets and come see us live. We're so excited.
We hope that you all had a wonderful Labor Day weekend today. Because of that holiday, we are going to share with you a very special conversation that Sarah had about If I Don't Make It, I Love You, Survivors in the Aftermath of School Shootings. This is a harrowing collection of 70 narratives covering over 50 years of shootings in America, written by those most directly affected by school shootings, the survivors.
The editors Amy Archer and Lauren Kleinman reached out to me and asked me to contribute. It was a total blessing and honor to be a part of all these survivors of school shootings coming together and sharing their perspectives. We had a really really great conversation. It was a healing conversation for me to talk about what the stories among the survivors have in common and how they differ and what everybody can take away from these stories. They're also leading a campaign right now to send the book to every single United States senator in the hopes that these first-person perspectives will push the conversation on legislative change forward. I think the work that they've done is so vital and so important, and I'm so happy they came on the show to talk about it. The book comes out today, Tuesday, September 3rd. So it is now available for purchase. You can get it wherever you purchase books. And without further ado, Amy and Lauren.
I am so excited to be joined today by Amy Archer and Lauren Kleinman, the editors of If I Don't Make It, I Love You, Survivors in the Aftermath of School Shootings. I'm also thrilled to be a contributor to the anthology and to have them here for an interview, which we'll publish on the book's birthday, on the day the book comes out. So Amy and Lauren, welcome so much to Pantsuit Politics.
Thank you. Hi, thank you.
Now, tell everyone a little bit about your backgrounds and what led you to put together this amazing book.
So I am a writer. I'm also a mom. And so I felt that Lauren and I had worked together on a previous anthology, and it was called My Body, My Words. And we worked with writers writing letters to their bodies. And when that was finished, we really, which is a rare thing in the art world, we really loved working together, and we found that we just collaborated really well. So we wanted to do another project, and we sat down, and we both knew that we wanted to do something surrounding gun violence. And so that's what brought us to this project. We started with a question: whatever happened to the kids who survived Columbine? Because like most people in this country, I was unaware of Heath, and I was unaware of Thurston and the shootings that had come before. So we started with that question, and that's what brought us here. And as writers, I am a memoirist, and Lauren has written memoir and poetry as well. We are really aware of the power of the personal story, and we felt that this was an aspect that was missing in this issue.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that Amy really sums that part up. I mean, I would also add to that that we're both teachers. So I think there's a natural, you know, part, I mean, at least in me, and I'm sure I can speak for Amy when I say this, to as writing teachers, to want to help people tell their story. So I think that was kind of a natural part, a part of this process. I think, you know, in addition to me being a writer, I also write a lot about my own experience with being a rape survivor. And I think there's been a lot of, for me, you know, a lot of interest in, you know, how do you go from, you know, experiencing X trauma to be able to talk about that? And how does that heal you or free you in a way? So that was really of interest to me, even though I didn't have direct experience with gun violence, there was still that part of me that really wanted to work with, or who always wanted to work with, survivors from all different kinds of trauma. So that's been really important for me in terms of, you know, the power of story and how personal storytelling also leads to social justice.
So how many survivors contributed to the book?
We have 84.
Wow. And so what is the range of how long ago was their shooting to how recent was their shooting?
Yeah, that's, you know, we covered from 1966, the
University of Texas. Wow.
Yes, the tower shooting. You know, horrifyingly so, there are way more, you know, shootings that have happened throughout history. I mean, you can go back, you know, to early century, you know, century before, and you find a lot of pockets of, you know, especially as guns, you know, I would say became more prominent in terms of when you're using that to claim your territory, et cetera. So it was a little bit more in use during, you know, during that time. And then, so we bring it from 1966, you know, to the Santa Fe shooting, you know, in May 2018. Unfortunately, there's still more shootings, mass shootings that are happening. So, you know, it's still an extensive timeline, you know, when you think about it. And I think what's been really interesting, and, you know, what Amy and I kind of talked about, was how we reversed the chronology of, you know, that we start with, you know, the Santa Fe shooting and we end with the Texas Tower shooting.
Well, that's what I think is so interesting is when you talk about using this to deal with the trauma, I think to have that broad range, like as someone, you know, who experienced a shooting in high school, I would be so interested to hear from somebody from the 1966 shooting to see how that affects you later in life. Like, it's almost like it can start, it's not just to help the individual person work through their trauma by telling their story, but it's also in the sharing and hearing of other people's story. It can almost serve like a guidebook, which I'm devastated that we need such a thing. But to allow someone, especially coming upon this experience for the first time, and to follow those stories and to see how people deal with them the further away they get from the trauma, I think that's such a like a great concept and a powerful gift to other survivors.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's really the story of each chapter is the story of a community.
Mm-hmm.
You know, each overcame this and healed in their own way, as did Columbine, as did Sandy Hook. So it's interesting to not only see how the survivors survived and persevered, but it's interesting to see, you know, how the support that the country gave them changed, how the media coverage changed. It's really a snapshot in history. Each little chapter is really the story of a community and a time in our country. So it's pretty interesting to also look at that.
Yeah, it's really fascinating from my perspective as a survivor, and particularly with Heath. I know that it doesn't have the historical impact of Columbine, but we definitely felt a lot of national support. I can still remember how the halls smelled filled with flowers. We got letters from everywhere. And the narrative, particularly in the media from our community, was that we were this hyper-Christian community. And that, I mean, I did an interview with a national news story, like with my little Bible in my lap, talking about how we'd already forgiven the shooter and how, you know, we hung walls in the sign, we forgive you because Jesus forgave us. And so like, there was like this really big story about our community, about how we forgave and healed and moved on in the national media that, I mean, we've got received a lot of support for that, obviously, particularly from religious communities, but to watch that play out over the decades and to see that like, no, you don't just check forgiveness off your list or check healing off your list and be like, we're done, moving on. And to see how we have continued to process and deal with this event as a community over time has been really interesting.
To me, it was really a learning experience to talk to the survivors from Texas from 1966. You know, just because many of them haven't really started talking about it until Parkland happened.
Wow. I think
that really kind of gave them, you know, some opportunity to come forward. But you also had some, obviously, that were talking about it, you know, anyway, prior to Parkland, obviously. But it's just really fascinating to me when they talked about the idea of survivor's guilt, you know, and also talked to, you know, just some of the things that we take for granted. You know, for example, you know, one of the contributors was talking about how, you know, the they didn't have ambulances during that time like we do now. So they were actually using hearses as ambulances.
Wow.
So, you know, it's just a very different, you know, just, you know, culture. And this was a time like, you know, when there weren't SWAT teams. You know, so you had the police, you know, running up there and doing that. So it's very interesting if you look at it just, you know, generationally.
Yeah.
Kind of the resources that were available then and now. So it's quite fascinating.
Well, and it's interesting. I have this like new component of survivor's guilt, which I'm going to call activist guilt. Like there's a part of me that's like, did we not push the conversation hard enough like the Parkland kids did? Could we have helped somebody if we pushed harder, if we'd been more outspoken, if we'd done more direct action? Like, you know, I was so angry because we had another shooting in our community. We have literally second generation school shooting survivors in my community now. And, you know, everyone was shocked and heartbroken. I was just pissed off. I was just like, you know what? Why is everybody so surprised? Like, we changed anything. We didn't change anything, and we expected different results. And so, like, I have this, like, weird, like, activist guilt because those kids, I think, pushed the conversation and the movement. Now, I think it was a confluence of really good funding, organization after Sandy Hook, social media, and all these changes. But I don't think you can discount the power and like the just the visceral anger. But their anger wasn't just this happened to us. It's that you see it still happening and no one's doing anything. And so it's happening to us in the face of light. Whereas we were still so shocked. And I think you still, I bet in the, particularly with Texas, like what they're dealing with is that it's not something everyone is acknowledging as this ongoing problem. Do you know what I mean? Like, because they weren't as prominent after, you know, even though that is still one of the like top 15 most deadly school shooting, mass shooting events in the country is still UT Austin from 1966. Was it Austin? Oh, is that right? Am I right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
UT.
So one of the things that we came across time after time after time is that activist guilt that you just mentioned. I worked specifically with the schools. Lauren and I divided the schools, and she worked with Texas and Virginia Tech and a lot of the secondary schools, and I worked with some of the high schools. So I worked with Thurston and Heath and Columbine, and you know, they were right in a row there. And I heard over and over and over again from survivors, I wish we did more. Why didn't we solve this? Why didn't we fix this? And to somebody from the outside, I mean, I'm the same age as all of you. I was a freshman in college when Columbine happened, or sophomore, regardless. But I'm the same age. So as somebody coming into this from the outside, my mind was blown that any of you who survived a school shooting felt that you owed us, the rest of the country, anything. And I was, and I remember talking with Jamie Amo. She's a survivor from Columbine, and she wrote a beautiful piece about feeling guilty that she didn't, quote unquote, fix this for her children. And I remember saying to her, like, we owed this to you. You didn't owe this to us. So that is very common, that it's, you're right, it's a different way of looking at survivor's guilt, but it's very prevalent amongst those schools.
Yeah. I mean, I think you see it because we're all having kids now. You know, our kids are going to school and we're thinking like, you know, what should we have done? Like, and I think you feel like when in the midst of it, you're like, okay, surely you will see our suffering and the fact that this seems to be getting worse and do something about it. And it's just so heartbreaking to feel like nothing's happening, especially when you go through something like that. I cannot fathom how the parents at Sandy Hook feel, because that's so, you know, just, it's like just a totally other level.
And the fact that nothing happened after that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the thing, though. I try to really push on that, though. I don't think nothing happened. I think you saw.
Right. I don't think nothing happened.
I think
right.
The Moms Demand Action and that organization and that sort of grassroots, well-funded grassroots is why you see. I mean, they're just laying the groundwork. It's not going to, you know, that's going to happen over time. And it's really interesting to see as someone who's watched it for so long. I mean, like, I went to the Million Mom March with my mother and a friend of mine and her mother, like after, you know, that was like post Columbine, the organization and the activism that happened post Columbine, and to see like sort of what happened and like kind of the rise and fall of these different groups. Mm-hmm. And like, this feels different to me as somebody who's been in it for a long time.
And I think you bring up a really good point too, Sarah, you know, about just survivorship and kind of what that trajectory has been like, you know, in America, because I see a lot of the same things, especially happening with, you know, survivors of rape and also women that, and I know I was in that group of women that didn't, you know, I didn't report, and I still feel so much guilt, you know, because you go, well, it's going to keep happening, you know, if I don't report, if I don't do something, like that idea of taking action, you know, as a part of your healing process, of your survivorship, of kind of being a part of that larger community. And I think right now what's happening, at least from what I've been seeing from my own point of view, I've really been noticing kind of this, I don't know if appreciation is the right word, but, you know, acknowledgement of what it means to be a survivor, you know, or the totality of what it means to be a survivor and all of the webbing that comes with that. You know, so, and I think that you see a lot of that in terms of the, you know, Moms Demand Action and, you know, a lot of organizations and different movements that are starting to come up across the country.
Did you see any other patterns, or did you notice anything interesting as you took in all these survivor stories, and not necessarily with regards to activism, but just, you know, the decisions they make or how they felt about their own stories or how their opinions and perspectives were either honored or not honored, or how they just, how that identity played out across a broad expanse of experiences?
Well, I think one of the things that you talked about is the forgiveness piece of it. And that was something that was really fascinating to me in terms of how, you know, how everybody forgives and, you know, but forgiving in terms of if you come from a religious community, you know, and one of the communities that we worked with was West Nickel Mines, the shooting at West Nickel Mines. And one of the things that was really, you know, prevalent in kind of that national conversation after that shooting was the rate at which the Amish forgave the shooter and the rate at which the community really came together. And when I went up to go visit with some of the families, you know, one of the things that they told me, which I thought was incredibly shocking, was, you know, when I asked them about this idea of forgiveness and how fast they were able to forgive and move on. And he said to me, you know, I don't know if I would have felt the same way if the shooter were to live. And I said, you know, well, why is that? You know, and he had said to me, well, there's revenge.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, probably a very natural reaction if you've been hurt, you know, to want to take some kind of action. But to hear it from somebody, especially from this man was like, you know, kind of considered an elder of this community, for him to say that was really shocking because it wasn't part of the narrative that was being told about that shooting.
Yeah.
So for me, that was a big eye-opener that there's this private space versus public space.
We will be right back after this short message from our sponsor. You know we love rituals to celebrate the changing seasons and the different celebrations in our lives. You guys, this year I committed to Olive in June as a part of my ritual. I really wanted to paint my nails more regularly, and I have done a great job. I don't mean to brag on myself, mainly because they make it so easy. It's really, really all about that Manny system, especially the nail strengthener, which I'm very passionate about. I just love using the colors to mark the fun things happening in my week. Lime fizz for St. Patrick's Day, sequin everything when I went to the beach, grateful and kind for Valentine's Day week. I just think it puts a little pep in my step. And they make it so easy with the system. The manicures last so long. It's like $2 a manicure, basically. They always have the most amazing polishes. I love following their Instagram for ideas about manicures. I just love everything about Olive and June. That's the long and short of it, guys. Visit oliveandjune.com/pantsuit for 20% off your first system. That's OliveAndJune.com/PantSuit for 20% off your first Manny system.
I'm not a research scientist, but I know that having a good hair day correlates with a good mood for me. And I have many more good hair days since I've been using Pros. I use the Pros shampoo, conditioner, curl cream, gel, and occasionally the hair mask. These products were formulated specifically for me, not for my hair type, but for me, what I eat, where I live, the specific issues that worry me about my naturally curly and very thick hair. Since I've been using Pros, I've noticed that I can go longer between washes without my hair looking dull or feeling oily. I've noticed that my curl structure is stronger and healthier. I've noticed that my hair has figured out how it wants to just lie on my head. I'm not fighting with it every day anymore. I feel like my hair and I have come to a peace truce. And that is really emotionally beneficial to me, in addition to producing lots of compliments on my hair everywhere I go. Pros is so confident that you'll bring out your best hair and skin that they're offering an exclusive trial offer of 50% off your first subscription order at pros.com/pantsuit. So get your free consultation, then 50% off at pros.com/pantsuit. That's PROSE.com/pantsuit.
Mm-hmm.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How is your social battery right now? Mine is at about 50%, and I'll tell you why. I have a tendency to overcommit. I want to help with everything I can possibly help with. I want to do everything I can possibly do. I want to be with people, and I forget that at the end of the day, I am an introvert, and I really need time to recharge and take care of myself. Therapy gives me important tools to do that, to recognize what's going on, to understand my battery and where it is and why it's there and what I can do to recharge. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online. It's designed to be convenient, flexible, suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/pantsuit today to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp.com/pantsuit.
I think it's so interesting, not just whether the shooter survives, but also whether or not there's a trial. Because yeah. I think what happened in our community was the basically the community leaders got together and decided we didn't need to go through a trial. That's pretty much the long and short of it. And so what I found myself learning as an adult, and that I think I would have had a better understanding and perspective of had there been a trial, was that this simple narrative that he was sick and we should forgive him, which really, I didn't ever feel a lot of anger towards our shooter. Like, it was just definitely like, he's sick. And that is true. He is diagnosed schizophrenic. Like, you know, he was sick. But at the same time, when I became an adult, I read, there was a book where, I can't remember the name of it, but where they go and they like, they tell the detailed stories of several shootings, and ours was one of them. And like, hearing about how many people knew, how many people he told, how the presence of guns in our community, just the quotidian nature of guns really contributed to this. And like, it just, but I didn't know any of that because there hadn't been a trial, you know, like yeah. I hadn't heard those perspectives. I hadn't heard that story of what the detailness, like the details of what happened. And hearing all that really shifted this like narrative I'd been telling myself that he was sick and there was nothing we could do. And then I hear all these details and I'm like, that's not true. You know, like that's not what happened. There was a lot going on here beyond a very troubled person.
Few Thurston survivors that wrote about the re-traumatization of having to go every time he's up for parole and mm-hmm. test against him again.
Wow.
So there's that aspect of it too. You know,
yeah.
Opening that wound.
And it's just there's such a complexity of experience. I would always tell people, I'm so glad we went to school the next day because we needed to be together because nobody understood what we were going through. Well, that was very easy for me to say as a person that was in the parking lot.
Right.
Much harder for somebody who literally stood in the hallways and saw their friend get killed and then was asked to go stand in that spot less than 24 hours later. Something we would never do. For another victim of violence. And so like, you know, that's an age thing. One of the most powerful things I ever heard, and I think it's the trauma of a school shooting in particular, is from a therapist who said, you know, the problem with something happens to you when you're young is that you don't have the tools to deal with it. And so as you grow and you develop new tools, you just have to process it again. Like you just, yeah. And now I don't feel at 38 that I'm reprocessing this in the way that I did from the age of 16 to probably 26 or 27. But there were a good 10 years where I had to just develop another layer of tools and understanding and reprocess. And that's the brutality of these experiences mm-hmm. as a teenager or a young person is like, you just don't have the capacity to fully take it in and process it at that young of an age.
Yeah.
And especially asking to do that with parole hearings and trials and going to the buildings and all that.
And it's such a personal experience. Like we have two people who wrote from the JCC in California, and they were both shot. Josh Stepakoff was 6 when he was shot. Mindy Finkelstein was his camp counselor, and she was 16. Both of them were told at the same meeting years and years later by another school shooting victim's mother, you speak for my daughter. You speak for my daughter who cannot. And what was interesting is Mindy, the older victim, she saw that as, I'm going to take this and I'm going to do something great with it. Like, this is a gift bestowed upon me by this woman. And Josh saw it as, this is somebody, you know, my life is being defined for me from something that happened to me at 6 years old. And he was more resentful.
Yeah.
So it was interesting because same experience, same school, same, you know, being told the same thing, and they both viewed it in very different way.
Oh, it's so, that is like the truth. I look at all my friends and I, you know, have realized that a lot of us had very different reactions. It was, life is out of your control. So meh, like you just take what comes. And my reaction, which is life can change. It's out of your control. So do it. Take what you can. Take it because everything could change on a Tuesday. Whereas like they're just it's just the smallest of shifts in their perspectives, which is everything could change. So just meh, float along. You know what I mean? And there's nothing right or wrong about either perspective. It's like total personality in a lot of ways. But it's so, I mean, we went through the same thing and we organized our life based on that experience in very different ways.
Yeah.
I think that's so interesting. What else did you see that surprised you as somebody not having this experience, just really deep diving into all these? I mean, you're talking about such a wide array of ages, experiences, and perspectives.
I mean, I think for me, and I, you know, we've been kind of writing about these experiences that, you know, I was expecting and not expecting things at the same time. I know that when I went to my therapist and had said, you know, this is the project that I'm, you know, undertaking. And she said to me, are you sure you want to do this with your history, with your own experience? Do you think that you're going to be able to do this? You know, and it was something that I really had to think about, because a lot of times when you've gone through that kind of trauma, you have a tendency to either project, you know, your own experiences onto somebody else without even realizing that you're doing it, you know, doing this kind of pain transference, you know. So it was really difficult for me, you know, and I think it was a learning experience in that it got me to think about what was going on with me in relationship to what was going on with these survivors, you know, and also how important it is to, you know, to be able to talk about what we were going through together, you know, having another partner there with you, because I don't think I was expecting it. I, you know, coming from like my body, my words, which was, you know, kind of a more relaxed, I would say, or maybe a text that didn't bring up as much baggage for me, that this was, you know, something that really affected me to the point of where, you know, I still have to go to therapy for this. I still have to write about this. There are still things that are conversations with parents that I don't know how I feel about just yet. You know, kind of like being pregnant myself right now and becoming a mom and, you know, replaying some of these stories in my head, sometimes it's hard for me to take myself out of that and keep myself in my own life.
Yeah.
So it's really, I wasn't prepared or really considered how much overall that this project was really going to kind of live inside of me for as long as it has been, and probably for a very long time.
And I agree. I started getting involved with Moms Demand Action about 3 weeks after Sandy Hook. My daughters, I have twin girls, and they were six. They turned six 2 weeks before the shooting at Sandy Hook. So it changed me as a mother, as a person, as an American. It absolutely changed me. So it was really hard for me. Lauren and I both made the decision to you know, be in therapy while we were working on this project.
It's very smart.
And it was really hard for me to not transfer that trauma to my children, to see them and not see, you know, Emily Parker or, you know, some of the kids that were killed. And it's really, I had to make like conscious decisions to keep the work that I was doing separate from them. They're 12 now, and I've spoken to them about school shootings, but not to the extent that, you know, I want to or I'm comfortable with yet.
Yeah.
So, and mostly because I can't even bring myself to tell them that nothing was really done about this after everything that had happened. It's almost like an embarrassment. So I had to make a real conscious choice to keep this away from them. And that was very, very difficult.
It's really interesting. I can't wait to read the book and listen to, and take in all these perspectives slowly. This will not be a quick read for me. But with my boys, like, it's so interesting. I have friends who did not attend Heath, whose children have a lot of anxiety about school violence, and mine don't. And there's a part of me that wonders if, you know, I never hid it from them. They've known about it since they were very, very little, but their orientation to it is, it happened to my mom and my mom is fine and she's here raising me and she's my mom.
Right.
You know, like, it's a really different orientation to it than most kids receive. Yeah. I talk about it as a very sad thing that changed my life and that is dangerous, but I don't think I talk about it in a way that I think it's scary. And I don't know if that's the difference. I've never been like, I always talk about it as a way that's like, it was a big thing in my life and it was sad, but I don't really talk to them about that they need to be scared.
It's a tough decision.
It's really tough. And I don't know if I'm gambling. Like, I don't know if there's a part of my subconscious that was just gambling. Like, it happened to me. It couldn't happen to my kids, even though now I know that's not true. I literally have friends who happened to their children in Marshall County. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know if that it's something I think about every time they leave the home for school. Mm-hmm.
Well, and this is the conundrum of an American mother,
right?
Do I traumatize my children by explaining that this can happen, by, you know, talking about what danger they are in their schools, or do I play the odds game and pray to God that doesn't happen?
Well, now it doesn't even matter. With the active shooter drills, it doesn't matter. You can't keep them from it, because they're going to have to do these drills at school.
And one thing we've learned with a lot of the recent shootings, the Santa Fe, the Parkland, the Marshall County shootings, is that, you know, a lot of these kids are just running on instinct. They don't remember in those moments what to do. I'm a big advocate for the drills in terms of staff and faculty and teachers and principals.
Yeah. But
I really struggle with, you know, traumatizing my 12-year-olds to learn how to survive a shooter in their 7th grade classroom when it might not be necessary.
You know, I think our school system made the decision. I think the teachers did the trainings before the kids got there this year. So that the teachers are, and it's still, you know, when you say a drill, it's not something you do once every 6 months. When you look at military drills or police drills, it's you have to teach your like lizard brain to react like that. Yeah. And that's something that's like a massive amount of repetition to achieve that kind of result. So the idea that we're going to pop a 5-year-old through a drill once a semester and it's going to have any effect is just making, there's so many things like, the shift in perspective from being a teenager, seeing the adults do these things and rolling my eyes because I thought, oh yeah, clear backpacks really going to make a difference. Yeah. And seeing it as an adult and realizing like why they were reacting like that as a parent, because you just want to think I did everything. But there's a really good book. I don't know if you've ever heard of Emily Oster. You should, if you're pregnant, you should absolutely read her book, Expecting Better. It's the only pregnancy book I ever recommend. She's an economist. And so she understands what studies are good based on their structure, which studies aren't good. And she just talks about like so much of our advice, and particularly is just sort of like a mix of like old wives' tales and junk science. But with parents, she's got a new book called Crib Sheets. And she's like, as parents, we're just so bad at assessing risk. We're just really, really bad at assessing risk and which of our behaviors will actually mitigate the risk. And so to be purchasing a bulletproof backpack and not like being concerned with car safety.
Right.
First of all, doesn't make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And second of all, that's not even going to mitigate the risk that you're thinking about. You know, like it's just, we're just bad at it. We're just bad at it as parents and as human beings.
Spring is so tricky because I feel the sun shining, the earth is waking up, and I want fresh vegetable forward meals. And I'm running in 75 directions and don't have a lot of kitchen and prep time. Fortunately, Factor is here for me and for you with fresh, never-frozen meals that are chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in 2 minutes. They have a ton of options for us, including keto, protein plus, vegan, veggie, calorie smart, and so many add-ons if you need help with breakfast or snacks or on-the-go lunches or beverages. Factor is here for you. Every meal I've had from Factor is so well composed, it's so flavorful, the sauces are delicious, and Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look for Earth Month Eats badges on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/pantsuit50 and use code pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code pantsuit50 at factormeals.com/pantsuit50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Do you want a bra that's sexy or a bra that's comfortable? Thanks to Third Love, you can have both. Third Love was started to take all the frustration, ick, and ugh out of bra shopping. That's why they made solutions for every bra problem, aka problems. Their bras make it easy to bring back perkiness you haven't seen since high school, get smoothing you know where, and have straps that actually stay put. Designed at their headquarters in San Francisco and made from premium materials, they put every style through hours of wear testing on real women, including themselves, before it's given the stamp of boob approval. Comfort and support are guaranteed. Plus, whether you're a AA cup or an H cup, their virtual fitting room will help you find your perfect fit fast. They even invented half cups. No more feeling stuck between two cup sizes that don't fit. It's time to get your problem solved. Visit thirdlove.com and get 15% off your order with code PODCAST15.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Well, and I think too, you also have to look at it's interesting, you know, and going back to you know, the folks that were there at the UT Austin, you know, shooting, that if you look back, you know, historically, when we, you know, when I was talking to them, you know, we were talking about, you know, the drills, etc., you know, they brought up, well, you know, we had to do it when we did the duck and cover drills, you know,
oh, yeah,
the threat of the Cold War.
And the kids were like, how is this going to help us? The duck?
Yeah, but, you know, he took, you know, a couple of them, you know, and including, you know, when I talked about this with my father, had said, you know, how traumatizing it was for them too. You know, like, we don't like look at that, you know, that piece as well. Like, but I think, you know, it's something that's kind of been going on in this country for a while, like a lot of this kind of fear.
But the difference there is they're not dropping nukes on Canada or Texas.
Yeah.
Like, this is happening.
Yeah.
Yeah. So true.
What I'm saying is that, you know, that it was still a traumatic experience.
Oh, yeah.
For those students.
Yep.
And it was still something that they lived with, you know, for a very long time, like that threat. And I'm talking about that, you know, as living with when you're under threat.
Yep.
You know, how do you react to that?
Yeah. It's so hard. And that kind of threat that's so amorphous and.
Well, it's intangible. Like it's abstract.
Mm-hmm.
It's nothing that you can really, you know, if I know something is like going to come at me, you know, like maybe I have a chance of moving away from it, you know, but it's kind of like one of the things that I hate to like bring it to, you know, but, you know, a lot of my family, you know, my husband's family in the military, you know, one of the things I was talking to a friend about who was at the Battle of Fallujah was saying, you know, all of this training that we did to protect ourselves meant, you know, really meant nothing and had everything to do with just luck when we were there, you know, because you know that it's coming, but how do you assess the threat in that way where you know that you're going to be safe? And I think just that fear of, am I going to be safe? You know, and I think about that as going through a rape and, even being in strange places, or, you know, how am I going to protect myself when I know that there are threats out there, but I can't really see it all the time?
Well, I think that this book is so valuable right now, because I do see, as someone who's been watching this for a long time, for better or for worse, I think the increase in mass shootings in environments outside of a school has shifted the conversation. I think particularly the proximity and time of El Paso and Dayton, two very different locations that stretch across the country, and two places that you don't need to have little kids to be thinking about all the time. Everybody goes to Walmart, okay? And everybody goes to bars. So I think, or most everybody. And so I think that, like, those locations, it you know, pushed it to a place where people realize, oh, like, this is going to get closer to me and closer to me and closer to me and closer to me. And so I think having these perspectives and this book out here right now for people to go to and understand, like, what is this? This doesn't stop when the cameras stop rolling. This doesn't change. This keeps affecting people long after there's another mass shooting that's soaking up all the oxygen in the national narrative. And so I thank you guys so much for putting this together, for reaching out to the survivors, for asking me to contribute. Like, I think it's going to be so powerful. And I just can't thank you enough.
Thank you, Sarah. We really hope so. I mean, it's been the hardest year of our lives, I would say, Lauren, probably, but also the most rewarding. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been an amazing experience. And I just want to say I was very lucky to have Lauren to go through this with, because we had many shared phone calls with tears and just, you know, the vicarious trauma that we experienced through this. And it's our hope that, you know, now we're doing a fundraising campaign to send a copy of this book to every sitting senator.
Love it.
Because it's our hope that once they read this book, they will feel the same way.
Yeah.
And people can find that fundraiser on our website, which is ifidontmakeitthebook.com.
And tell us where else they can find the book and promote the book.
You know, they can go on Twitter. They can go on Facebook. You know, and right now it's also available on, you know, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Skyhorse Publishing website, you know, pretty much anywhere where books are being sold, with the release being September 3rd.
All right. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show and sharing your perspective.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much to Amy and Lauren and Sarah for that powerful conversation. Again, the website is ifidontmakeitthebook.com, and there is a GoFundMe campaign to make sure that every senator gets a copy of this important work. You can follow along on Twitter at ifidontthebook.
We will be back in your ears on Wednesday over at The Nuanced Life. If you want to listen to us discuss things outside politics and commemorations from important moments of life beyond the funerals and the birthdays and the retirements and the weddings, join us over there. And then until then, we will be back at Pantsuit Politics on Friday. And until then, keep it nuanced, y'all. Dylan Garvin produces Pantsuit Politics every week. Thanks for making us sound better, Dylan.
Elise Knapp is our managing director, which means we could not make it without her scheduling, organization, feedback, and creativity. Thank you, Elise.
We couldn't make Pantsuit Politics without support from our listeners. Go to patreon.com/pantsuitpolitics to learn how you can receive more nuance and help us make the show.
Special thanks to our executive producers who have committed to supporting us in a major life-giving way.
Our executive producers are Tracy Putoff, Tim Miller, David McWilliams, Joshua Allen, Linda Rucker, Martha Bernotsky, Melanie Cravey, and Tiffany Hassler.
Our theme music is composed and performed by Dante Lima. The music under our ads is composed and performed by Dylan Garvin.
Learn more about our lives, live events that we're involved in, and what we're reading each week by signing up for our weekly newsletter at pantsuitpoliticsshow.com.
And connect with members of the Pantsuit Politics community by following us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter.